America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Truth, I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Our next guest is Tony Gosling. Boy, I can't say enough about this fella. He's had all kinds of Greater London radio experience, BBC programming, and all over the UK. Right, he's presently hosting a very, very interesting program in Bristol, England, called Friday Drive Time. Now, if you think this program is just about Bristol, Drive Time in the surrounding area of Bristol, you got something else coming. Tony reaches way, way out all over the world, and he really does a fine job. Welcome to our program, Tony Gosling.
Thanks, George. Yeah, we do pretty much a bit of local news. I mean, it just so happens that some local news here in Bristol's hit right around the world this week, which is the introduction, which is happening next month, of a Bristol, something called the Bristol Pound, which is our own local currency. You know, we like to think of ourselves as a pretty switched-on city, and it's quite clear that the financial criminals in the Western world, mostly, are really hell-bent on destroying our economy by thieving from us all. So it's nice to know that this new currency, which is starting in September, called the Bristol Pound, will be actually good for the payment of all the local taxes around here. So that's really the one thing it needs to be in order to pick up. So you can pay your council tax with it, then it's something which is going to be start circulating. And it's a whole bunch of, I suppose, what you call them, you know, festival organisers, these kinds of people that run a community arts centre that have got it all going. And so that's really made headlines in many corners of the world, actually, the fact that we've decided we're having our own currency. Not surprisingly, one of the big investment banks around here called Hargreaves Lansdown, which, of course, has been effectively bailed out by the government. I mean, these guys that are in their big, tall buildings at the moment would be signing on the dole queue, waiting for their social security payments, if it hadn't been for us bailing them out. They are saying that they think the whole thing is nothing more than a sort of some kind of shopping voucher scheme, and that it won't last 5 minutes. But I can tell you the opposite is true. And I think the fact that they're saying that is probably because they're afraid that this currency might actually at some point in the future become much more useful than their fictional money that they peddle on their computers.
Boy, I tell you what, sounds like the continental colonies were issuing. Huh? I mean, you're issuing something that you can stimulate and prosper the trade and exchange of goods there in Bristol. I think it's beautiful.
It is, yeah. And it's nice to have a good news story for a change, because, I mean, most of the stories here are pretty bad. Although, you know, looking at, for example, Britain's treatment of Assange makes you ashamed to be British. But, I mean, I suppose what we do is we think of William Hague, who, by the way, is running the country on his own this week, because Clegg, the Deputy Prime Minister, the Liberal Democrat, and the Conservative David Cameron are both away in Spain on holiday. So William Hague, the Foreign Secretary, is in charge, and he's making a real hash of it. I suppose you've seen that 30 American states are getting together next week to discuss Britain's ridiculous and appalling threat to storm the Ecuadorian embassy.
What is going on right now about that?
And I reckon one of the best tactics of the pro-Assange campaigners would be all to go home with their girlfriends and their wives and get themselves sort of dressed like exactly like Assange, to dye their hairs blonde, and to start walking in and out of the Ecuadorian embassy in London, opposite Harrods. To get them biting their nails, because this is an appalling situation that the guy has been under house arrest in the Ecuadorian embassy.
Now, didn't some of that WikiLeaks, didn't that expose some of this money laundering of these big banks, though, here lately?
Well, of course they have.
I think you may not agree with me, George,
but I think probably the most important leak which WikiLeaks has done, I mean, of course the film of the American helicopter pilots killing the Reuters reporter and the Reuters cameraman, which was one of the first WikiLeaks. That was very important. I mean, there have been loads of important things, but for me, the one that really touches me is the report from the International Atomic Energy Authority addressed to TEPCO and to the Japanese government requesting that they close down the Fukushima reactor 6 months before the disaster, saying that actually the reactor was not prepared and it was not built in a good enough way to protect against a tsunami. This is the value of Assange and his leaks. That actually what's going on there is he is exposing the way our governments are covering up. I mean, I don't know quite, you know, what the attitude in the United States is towards your own government. Probably not very positive. Ours isn't at the moment, too. But in the past, we've had actually very good governments here, open governments. I mean, particularly after the Second World War, we have what was basically a socialist government, but they were doing a lot of good work in a very open fashion. So what they were doing is they were running utilities in the country, the basic essentials of life. We're talking about things like electricity, water, this kind of thing. And they were doing it in a totally transparent fashion. In other words, any citizen could go down, find out exactly where the money was going, and the accounts were all open, the books were open. That worked very, very well for probably 20 years or so after the war. And I know that, you know, a lot of Americans think socialism is a bad thing. Our health service, I can tell you, is a fantastic thing to have. It really means that, you know, the way it came about really was from the Blitz on London, where people were dragging bodies out from under buildings. And the last thing they wanted to do was to say, OK, where's your health insurance? You know, it was everyone was in it together, and they really were. It was one massive community fighting
Johnny,
and they decided to have a health service for everybody, not just for those who could afford to pay.
You know, that was featured on the opening of the Olympic Games, and they had demons scurrying across hospital beds, scaring little kids out of their beds. Did you
see
that?
That's right, and that's because those demons are running amok right now.
I mean,
private healthcare industry trying to destroy this wonderful National Health Service. I mean,
some of your
listeners are really not into the socialist principles and things like that, but you can take some of the basic essentials of life and you can run them in a very good fashion as a whole community, so long as, and this is a really important caveat to that, so long as the books are open and you know exactly who's doing the appointing, who's appointing who to what jobs, what all their individual interests are, and if you think that there's something going on that shouldn't be, you can whistleblow without any fear of losing your job. That was the situation here in Britain in the 1950s and the 60s and roughly up until the 70s until we started privatising these basic essential services.
Well, now, under Thatcher, that started, did it not, under Thatcher?
Margaret Thatcher. She was very much in the thrall of a guy called Victor Rothschild, who, funnily enough, was a Labour peer. And Victor Rothschild had Mrs. Thatcher under his wing. One of the other things that they brought in was this thing called the community charge or the poll tax.
They rioted in London because of that, didn't they?
That's right. There's a very good film about that called The Battle of Trafalgar, which shows the way that the Metropolitan Police actually ran a transit van into the crowd in order to start that riot. It was about 40, 45 miles an hour, a transit van actually rammed the crowd, a police van. And so that's how that riot started. But it was basically the idea being that the tax is on you as a person, not on the owner of the property. Now, if I was a government and I wanted to raise taxes, I would put that tax on the person who is clearly the more wealthy of the two, the one with the property.
Yeah, you know what came to my mind in this, and you put out really good emails. I thank you for all of that. Trapwire is something that got into the WikiLeaks deal, didn't it?
Well, we would know nothing about it, George, I think it's fair to say. I'm afraid our rather slack and useless mainstream press here in the Western world, if it wasn't for WikiLeaks, and it makes it quite clear that this system is already in place over here in the UK as well, installed in Downing Street, so these emails are saying. They fulfill such an important role. I think it's also fair to point out that as soon as this trapwire information appeared on WikiLeaks, it was this massive distributed denial of service attack.
Yes, you know, that was very important then, was it not? Well, you know, we've known about Echelon for years, right?
That's right, yeah.
And so this is even more insidious and further spread, and they're using more and more data and licensed plate readers facial recognition, and so forth, to and watch list. Well, that's what I don't like, watch list. That's insidious.
Well, I mean, I don't like watch list.
I think, you know,
we're in a sort of Spartacus situation, aren't we? They're trying to use fear in order to really kind of keep us quiet and set us up, that kind of thing. And make us self-censor, essentially, to sort of limit our freedoms ourselves, rather than for them to actually be limiting our freedoms. What they want is to create fear inside their own mind, so that we limit, they don't have to, we're already afraid. And I think once you get to the point where you realize the extent of some of these systems, then, in a way, everyone is Spartacus. You know, everybody can look at each other and go, well, you know, they can't actually get us all, can they? I think that's the sort of situation we're in now. The other thing, of course, is, I mean, I've visited some of these CCTV centres here in the UK, and I can tell you there are some, particularly in the private sector, some really nasty figures. That is, people who simply want, you know, if you've ever seen the George Markstein's 1969 series, The Prisoner, George, have you?
No, I haven't.
This is a series which went right across the world, actually, in the Western world anyway, in the 60s. It's based on true fact. MI6 had a few secret agents during the end of the Second World War who were really crazy people. You know, they'd gone a bit too crazy. Also, they knew too much. I mean, one of the other things that we could talk about is this business about Adolf Hitler not necessarily dying outside the bunker like we've all been told. Anyway, these spies were kept up in a castle in Scotland, which was actually surrounded by really high security, really just to make sure they didn't get out and that the secrets that they knew didn't get out because they were too dangerous. And this series by George Markstein was put together in the 60s with Patrick McGoohan, who played Danger Man in a previous series, really to I suppose, entertain us all with this idea that the secret agent that knows too much tries to resign, goes back to his flat, finds that his gas is coming into his flat, he's anaesthetized, and taken to this place called The Village. And in The Village, everyone is sort of smiling, and basically what they're trying to do is to find out why he resigned, and he doesn't want to tell them. So the whole entire series is based on him trying to escape from The Village and them trying to find out why he resigned, what he knows, who he might be aligned to, and really to control him. So that's the kind of thing that, you know, you could see prophesied in a weird way back in 1969 in this series, because in this village everybody is under surveillance, and that, it seems, is the kind of vision that some of the more fascistic elements within the Western world want to see. And of course the problem, it gets greater with the less accountability, going back to what I was saying before, and the more this gets privatized and covered by issues of commercial confidentiality, the worse things are going to be. We should not have any kind of real private security industry, in my mind. The only people who should be allowed to, you know, sort of police these kind of areas are officials who are accountable, not, you know, private companies who, you know, let's face it, all private businesses will want to do is a deal with somebody. If someone comes along and offers them money to do something, they'll do it. There's no way that the security industry should operate like that.
Right. You know, the way I see it on the communications is that the government should not have the right to encrypt or do any secret communications, and that would make it totally transparent. But individuals should have a full right for full encryption of powers and ability to encrypt anything at any time among themselves.
If we go back to Phil Zimmerman, I think, and his system for encryption back in the 1990s. I remember I had that.
Yeah. Phil Zimmerman, and him being prosecuted for
his piece of software supposedly being a weapon of war, prosecuted through the U.S. courts, and eventually he won. Yes, you're absolutely right. The government should be open about everything it does. And I think what's happening is, certainly here in Britain, I don't know how far advanced this is in the U.S., but many local authorities, like here in Bristol, in other cities around the country, and of course the central government, are seeing themselves more and more as if they're running a business. This is actually the road to fascism. They are not running a business, they're running a public service.
Exactly. Well, the public-private partnerships on the Davos and all that stuff, they've been pushing that for years at Bilderberg meetings at Davos, you know what I mean, World Economic Forum and all that other stuff. So they want to take, you know, public funds and transfer that, those interests into a private type of scheme.
Yeah, but George, if you want to use the word partnership, it makes me laugh. It's the kind of partnership that an oak tree has with the ivy that's strangling it, you know.
Oh,
that's
gosh,
the kind of partnership that these companies want. They want to actually use these important public outfits in order to get
suckers
into them.
They'll have unlimited capital at what it seems.
It's more of a parasitic-style relationship.
Yeah, well, they'll have unlimited capital through a public type of relationship with government, see. That's what they're looking at, see.
That's right.
Every corporation has a certain capital base and, you know, limits, but with going in with the public, then they can expand that credit infinitely, see. See what I mean? And so,
yeah, well, that's right.
Yeah.
I mean, I just like the idea. I mean, one very, very basic fact, and it goes back to Jekyll Island, is the idea of our banking sector actually not being some kind of get-rich-quick scheme, you know, it's a good game if you can get it kind of thing, for private individuals to rerun. This should be a public utility. It's like the water system, you know. If the banking system ain't working, people start to die. Yeah, and this is what's starting to happen here in Britain, and it's happening in many parts of the Western world, is that essential public services for the most vulnerable in society are starting to crumble. People are starting to die. And I don't know how many are going to have to die before someone actually decides they're going to take this back under the control of ordinary people. I mean, it does seem that a lot of the people who are making money out of this are actually part of cults, you know, that they're actually in it, you know, they're not actually in government in any way to serve the public. They're in to serve their friends, and they're in basically, whether they're formal or informal, secret conspiracies to, you know, what they do is they'll do what they shouldn't be doing, that is helping their mates rather than the public whilst they're in public office. And as soon as they leave public office, like Tony Blair, they find that they're either given really lucrative jobs on the boards of these massive corporations, or else they, you know, they get these marvellous sort of lecture tours when the guy should be in jail, frankly. I mean, you know, he should be tried and I would hope found guilty of the crimes of illegal a war, which also looks as if, by the way, it's happening right now in Syria, you know, with many of the Western powers helping this Free Syrian Army, and I would say egging them on with all this kind of Quran ideology, saying, I mean, I don't know how many of your listeners are familiar with the Quran, but there's a lot in there which talks about, you know, the sort of unbelievers being vanquished from the Arab world. And this is the sort of thing I think NATO are playing on.
Yeah.
They're going in there. They're saying, you can be a hero. It says so in the Quran. Here's a Kalashnikov. Here's an anti-tank weapon. Here's some anti-aircraft missiles. Off you go, guys, and fulfill, you know, what Allah wants you to do.
Hey, what do you think about this imminent coming new, worse than 2008 financial banking collapse? Do you see it in the 3 to 4, 5, 8 months out from here, or what?
Listen, I really don't know, and I think actually the fact of the matter is that this kind of thing could collapse at any time. It's a bit like the Wall Street business back, you know, in the 20s, 30s, all that whole era. It's when they actually decided that the banking elite decided they wanted to crash the economy. They just did it that day. And I think they're in that situation right now with the whole euro crisis and the dollar crisis. Look, I mean, I think whatever, though, is going to be a whole lot worse than last time. That's pretty sure. I actually personally look to the Book of Revelation to you know, when I'm considering this whole business, because, you know, you have to look, I think, you have to have some sort of context to it all. That's my context, and that's part of my faith. But all I'll say is, you know, what you're getting there is you're getting the four horsemen. You're getting the white horse, you're getting the red horse, the black horse, and the pale horse. I think when these events come, whether it's in a few years' time or, you know, a decade or whatever the time period, that book is there to reassure us as these events unfold. If you read what the Apostle John says in Revelation, you'll see that the first one is the white horse. This is a little bit obscure. Some people say you know, it could have something to do with the war on terror, possibly. Anyway, anyway, the Red Horse is absolutely clear. That is a massive outbreak of global war of some sort, you know, really enormous. And then the Black Horse is a really interesting one. It's about, it talks about an economic collapse. So it's talking about these events happening in this order, yeah? And an economic collapse where food is actually very, very difficult to get hold of and extremely expensive, this kind of thing. And then the final one is the Pale Horse, which is a lot of people dying. Actually, it's what it actually says, I think, is a third of the world dying because of disease and famine brought on by the war and by the economic collapse. So, I mean, when this happens, I have no idea. And, of course, you know, there's only a few cultists, the financial criminals and their little cult, that will know when this is going to happen. They'll do it at a time that they hope is going to be convenient for them. But, of course, it won't, because there's nothing they can really do. Ultimately, at the end of the day, they are going to lose. And so this is one of the reasons I think that they're getting particularly desperate, because they are ultimately the losers in the Battle of Armageddon. But, I mean, we've had quite a lot of stuff coming out in the last few weeks. I'm talking about books that I've come across, have landed on my doorstep for one reason or another. Probably the hottest at the moment is this book by John Morgan about the assassination of Princess Diana. And I must say, it's the most readable, easy to flick through, well indexed. It's only about 160 pages, but what John's done there is he's crystallized out all of the most important facts to do with why Diana was killed, exactly how it was done, who by, which is probably the most important, you know, the indications beforehand, and also, that is to say, indications beforehand to her and her friends that there was a threat to her life. Her amazing premonition saying that she's going to die in a car accident organized by her husband. And, you know, this is called the Paris-London Connection, the assassination of Princess Diana. And I'm sure you can get it on most of these book sites now, but it's only come out in the last couple of weeks. So that's one I'd really point to as a very important, because the British royal family is actually, you know, historically important, and it's quite powerful still here in Britain. I mean, a lot of British people think, oh, it's just some kind of thing that people want to come and see the palaces and all this, whatever. Actually, they are a particularly right-wing bunch, as Diana found out to her cost. When I say right-wing, I mean, you know, really fascistic, and certainly Prince Philip is racist. I mean, he's, you know, in his 90s now, and he's in hospital at the moment up in Scotland. But, I mean, I met recently someone who'd worked with Philip, and he himself was incredibly racist. I mean, these people are sort of supremacist types. And also, of course, all of the armed forces owe their allegiance not to David Cameron, but to the Queen. You know, so they are still quite a powerful bunch, George.
Yeah, you know, when that happened, we looked into it. And there was all kinds of different factors and you know, I mean, a side swiping that possibly occurred, probably, and all kinds of carbon monoxide poisoning, probably. I mean, it reeked of assassination.
The main reason I think she was killed, and there's not much doubt about this.
Yeah, what is that?
Is her campaign against landmines. This brought together the arms industries of Britain and France. Obviously, she had been upsetting the royals by fraternizing with a Muslim. I mean, what was happening when she was due to come back to London, this is very little, there's been a lot of disinformation about this, but we've got the facts now that Dodi Al-Fayed bought a $200,000 ring for Diana. A painting was also painted of the two of them together, and they were going to announce their engagement when they returned to London. Now, the idea of a Muslim being the stepfather to Prince William and Harry really, I think, was a bit too much for the royals to bear. And this combined with the fact that she was a major threat to the arms industry of anti-personnel landmines, whilst it was a fantastic cause, I think she basically took on the landmines industry and lost eventually. So that's one book that's come out recently. The other one I really must plug a little bit, and that is by a former member of the European Parliament and also a British mainstream press journalist back in the days where there were journalists, and he would be one of the first to admit that in the Western world that journalism is dead now virtually, and that's Richard Cotterell at Cotterell, and he's just come out fairly recently with this book, Gladio, NATO's Dagger at the Heart of Europe, the Pentagon Nazi Mafia. And this is really looking at false flag attacks throughout the post-war period right up till today, and looking at certainly at some of the attacks that were supposed to have been done by the IRA, but in Northern Ireland and on the British mainland, but then were then found to have nothing to do with the IRA, where the British Army government, certain departments like the Force Research Unit in the British Army, were actually blowing up ordinary innocent British people and then saying, hey, it's the IRA. This, of course, was going on right across Europe in places like Italy. There were lots of this going on. The Red Brigades were the ones that were being blamed in Italy. And then the same happening in Germany with the Baader-Meinhof gang being blamed, and in Belgium as well. Some really horrendous massacres carried out by elements within our military, the far right really within the military, and then blamed on supposedly Russian communist sympathisers and communist agents. So that's, I think, a really interesting read, and he looks at loads of different aspects of this which are absolutely fresh, particularly a lot of the academic studies on Operation Gladio, this NATO really a terror operation on the European domestic population. A lot of them have missed out this angle with the British. It's all a bit mysterious, but it's quite clear now that this was part of a much wider thing right across Europe in order to effectively turn politicians, most importantly, but also general populations and the media against the whole sort of Soviet bloc. You know, that was the idea, was to get the politicians to, go along with America in a military kind of alliance. Things like allowing these cruise missiles to be stationed, American troops to be stationed right across Europe. That was a result of that. And I noticed, talking about Europe this week, George, that for the first time since World War II, the German Wehrmacht, or is it, they call it the Bundeswehr now, don't they, is now able to operate outside Germany. And the Germans have admitted they've got a highly developed military drone program. So the Germans are now strutting onto the world stage as a military power again for the first time since World War II.
Yeah, if you see a drone and speak in Germany, you know where it's coming from, don't you?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, nine!
That's right. I mean, we also had 2 weeks ago, so they've got such bad timing, these Germans. Head of their secret service, Heinrich Fromm, he was forced to resign because it showed that he'd been actually supporting neo-Nazi groups throughout Germany who'd been carrying out racist assassinations on Turkish people. So, it looks like we haven't actually come that far. We haven't come as far as we'd like to think we had.
Hey, Tony, can you do a couple more? Yeah. Can you do a couple of more segments, or do you need to go?
Of course I can, George.
Okay, we'll start at the 6 after the hour there, and we'll come back for a couple of 10 more minute segments. But thank you for being with us, Tony. We certainly do appreciate your keen insight. And, man, you say it like it is. You do a great job. Thank you, Tony. We'll be right back. Welcome back to our program, Tony Gosling.
Thanks very much, George. Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, this word fascism keeps popping up sometimes in our conversations. Is that Martin Bormann and all that dynamics of all that money, is that visiting us today in our modern world, all that money?
It certainly is. And I picked up on this expression that Gordon Duff at Veterans Today uses quite a lot, George, and that is economic determinism. I mean, what's happened here is we've got a massive load of loot from the Second World War, which the Nazis had a year to get out of Berlin and to squirrel away around the world. That loot was all laundered over the period of about 10 years, some maybe a little bit longer, through the Nazi networks in South America mainly, and some through Alan Dulles' law firm, Sullivan and Cromwell, in New York. And that money was then invested in some of the big companies which are doing so nicely, thank you very much, today. The only thing is, of course, that the directors of those companies it's very, very difficult to prove this stuff, because cults come in lots of different forms. I mean, what have we got? We've got the Masons, the Mormons, the Jehovah's Witnesses, the Scientologists, we've got witchcraft, we've got the really sort of dark satanic cults as well. But, I mean, it's not difficult to imagine a situation where these cults are basically appointing themselves, other members of those cults, to these big corporations. I mean, we've got a big company, for example, in London called Odgers, And what they do is they specialize in corporate appointments. They have a list of people, and they say, oh, this guy here is really nice. This guy here is fantastic. And these are the people that then get appointed to run these massive corporations. So you don't need to be a genius to work out what's going on here. You've got I mean, of course, the SS was a cult as well, you know, a Hitler worship cult, and a death cult as well. So that, I think, is what we're dealing with in the West, and we've really got to get our act, you know, together and over the next few years, however it happens, we've got to deal with the problems in our own midst. I mean, we're obviously being set against Russia and China right now. I mean, we're getting particularly a lot of propaganda here in Britain about how terrible Vladimir Putin is, that the Russians are a really dreadful race. I mean, I'm getting fed up with hearing this. You know, we've been hearing it, what is it now, 50 years or so, how terrible they are. Actually, on the world stage, they seem to me to be some of the only people who are talking sense, trying to stop the explosion of Syria, the only people who are really, it seems, are really pushing that. So, you know, ultimately, that's what we're dealing with. I think we're going to have to sort out, get our acts in order and get our house in order with regards to the way we govern our big companies and the ownership of our wealth. Because, of course, so much wealth now is going out of the hands of ordinary people and individuals, and certainly very little common land and, you know, stuff which is just there for anybody that wants it. There's very little of that around. And it's being sucked up by these massive corporations. And when the corporations start taking over the government, as they are here doing in Britain, I mean, for example, the healthcare industry taking over our hospitals, the private academies, companies taking over our schools, as has happened so much, with so much of our life here in Britain has now been taken over by these private businesses. I mean, that essentially is the road to fascism. What we've seen over the Olympics was quite interesting, which is the use of this private security firm, G4S, who were proved to be actually rubbish at doing any security, but they were still going to be paid, and still have been paid, roughly £300 million for making a mess of things. I mean, this is where the way things are going, I'm afraid. So, yeah, you're right, fascism, that's the way the West is heading. And, you know, it's very difficult to stop that creep. And this is what concerns me, is that as if there's any kind of successful inroads made to stop that creeping run towards fascism, then the fascists will fight back. And at the moment, they are banking, it seems, on some kind of war in the Middle East kicking off. You know, you've got so much military hardware surrounding Iran and the Gulf and loads of military bases. You know, God only knows what's going to happen down there, George.
Right. You know, you've got these very evil characters hiding behind humanitarian campaigns to help the poor Syrian people, don't you? Huh?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. But I think,
I mean, these are masters of deceit.
Yeah, it staggers me to see on our mainstream news, you know, night after night after night, only a one-sided view. I mean, I was watching the news here this evening in the UK, and they're saying, you know, here's a video of an attack which has taken place by the Syrian army, and by the way, we can't verify the video. And well, my question is, well, why are you showing it then? You know, one of the basic tenets of journalism. You have to verify the facts before they become news. If they're not verified, they're not news. There's a fantastic article, by the way, if any of your listeners want to check it out, by Charlie Skelton, who also does the Bilderberg stuff for The Guardian.
Oh, yeah, Charlie's great, yeah.
He's dug out all of the background on much of the so-called Syrian opposition in the West. Many of these organizations are linked with Western intelligence services, all sorts of front organizations, and basically what's happened is that NATO and the Israelis and their allies have created a kind of shadow government and a whole kind of shadow propaganda outfit to constantly feed to the Western people to say, oh, that Syria is falling to pieces, it's no good, and here is a whole load of people who are ready to take over, and they've all got smiling faces, they've got clean teeth, and, you know, this is really... I mean, we're going down the Goebbels propaganda road night after night after night. I mean, well, I did an examination, George, of one of these videos that they showed. They were trying to make out that there were big, as this is back actually earlier in the year, that there were big attacks going on in Damascus on Channel 4 News. And it was Jonathan Miller, their foreign correspondent. And what he'd done is he tried to show that an attack that had been recorded by his cameraman as the camera was just recording as he was going back to the car, and it was a series of gunshots. He said, oh, it links up exactly, the gunshots on the tape link up exactly and align exactly with some other gunshots on a YouTube film which were shot in Damascus. Now, I actually went back over that piece of film and the audio of the film. I stripped it out, and there was no similarity whatsoever between these two. So they are lying to us.
Yes, yes.
They're
propagandizing with, you know, and they're lying and manipulating the film and the sound and audio and everything. You know, we've caught them numerous times in putting together propaganda.
Yeah, sleight of hand and trickery, where the public are being conned and fooled by our mainstream press.
Well, the occult is into magic and trickery and deception and mastermind control, are they not?
Yeah, I think they are, and it's not always
that's their game,
that are doing this. Sometimes they're working with them, the production staff, people who are behind the scenes whose faces you never see. I mean, this is one of the things about television is that, you know, and broadcasting generally, is there are a lot of people doing work behind the scenes that you'll never see their faces. You don't even know who they are. Quite a lot. I mean, for example, our local regional news here in by the BBC doesn't have any announcement as to who the editor is of that program or the producer whatsoever at the end of the show. You know, this is just the news, you know, and that's the BBC. So, you know, if they can sort of disappear the staff from the credits at the end of the program, then you realise something's definitely wrong. So that's one of the things I would always suggest is you look at the credits at the end of the news bulletins just to see that there actually is someone who's prepared to put their name to it, because if there isn't, then, you know, I wouldn't believe a word that's in that news bulletin.
Right. We're going to take another break here and end up with our last segment coming up in just a few minutes. But thank you for being with us, Tony.
Thanks, George.
Another thing
I've been looking into this week, which is really fresh new, I mean, this is really brand new stuff. I mean, we know quite a lot about what happened with the railways in the United States, that the Rockefeller family were behind the really the destruction of the railways in the United States through the streetcar systems in many American cities were closed down by this company, National City Lines. I mean, this is fairly well documented. It was Firestone Tire and Rubber Company, Mack Truck, General Motors, and the various Rockefeller oil interests that bought up these wonderful transit systems in many cities in the US and basically just ran them into the ground, forcing people to buy cars so they would be dependent on oil. I mean, that was quite well known for many years, you know, the Rockefeller family absolutely in the frame for that. You know, this is really an appalling state of affairs, you know, particularly with, you know, the state of our environment, the massive addiction that we've now got to having to have oil, massive amounts of oil, and that has all sort of also linked up with the Nazis and their Autobahn program. Now, it's not really been very well known up till now what interests were at play in Britain, because, as you probably know, we invented railways over here, and our railway network, by the end of the Second World War, is one of the things that helped us win the war, by the way, was the fact that we were able to build sort of had factories under railway tunnels, this kind of thing, build aero engines, build, you know, large parts of airframes in, deep underground, and then move this stuff around the country by train. Bristol, actually, by the way, was at the end of World War II building more aircraft per week than anywhere else on the planet. And, you know, a lot of this stuff was, you know, the basic parts, like the engines and things, were being run backwards and forwards by the trains. And we had a fantastic network, really incredible, where you could literally go on a tram, mostly, or a bus, and get from one part of Britain to anywhere else. The other thing is, you could transport livestock, anything. You take it down to your local station, leave it there, a train would come along within a matter of however many hours, and it would go into the goods system as well. So we had a parallel passenger and goods system, which was the best in the world, bar none. It was really, you know, used, I suppose, to help build the empire, which is a sort of rather a dark side of our past, but it was a very efficient network. And so many people were scratching their heads in the 1950s and 1960s as to why all the railways around Britain started closing down. Now, this was all down to a man called Dr. Beeching, He's been called Doctor Who because although everybody knows that he's the guy that destroyed our railways, nobody really knew much about him until we found out that he was actually involved in the 1940s and 1950s, early 1950s, with a company. I mean, he was before the war. He was in ICI, which is a big chemical company. That was a big part of the war effort, obviously, making chemicals for explosives and munitions and that kind of thing. But what wasn't known up until literally now was that he was one of the main people involved in the development of the British atomic bomb as well, in a secret base on the North Downs, just in Kent, just south of London, called Fort Halsted. That's basically right under the ground, and it's right next to the Home Secretary's Chevening country residence, conveniently. But this is new to us here in Britain, and this is just stuff which is literally just coming out this week, revelations that actually the guy that closed down our railways was also the man behind one of the few scientists and physicists behind the development of the British atomic bomb after World War II. So not only did he develop the bomb, he also bombed our transport system virtually out of existence. We're now in a situation here where it's ridiculously expensive to use the train, a little bit like it is over in the United States as well. So, you know, it took us a few years to catch up with destroying our railway network, but I'm afraid we managed to do it too, George.
Well, I tell you what, these guys are always after something, aren't they? Some angle. Hey, the story broke today. Reuters broke it by way of the New York Times. New York Times first published the story, but it was about the Dutch bank. It says here that the investigation of Dutch bank is in early stages. So far, there's no suspicion and so forth, but they are being accused of moving money, Iranian money around, and Sudan and these other countries, but these big banks, along with Standard Chartered, okay?
I personally think that these sanctions are a bad idea in the first place. I think we should be allowing the free flow of capital to these countries because often the sanctions, George, are used just as a prelude, basically as a way of economically bullying a country before, you know, the military move in. And so they're often actually started by clandestine economic warfare offices around the Western world. I mean, this is one of the most important parts of warfare now. We've got to remember, warfare isn't necessarily about tanks and aircraft anymore. It's about things like cyber warfare, these denial of service attacks against the Syrian Arab News Agency, against the Russia Today, as well as WikiLeaks over the last few days. There's also, obviously, satellite weapons and this kind of thing up there now, and that sort of thing. But, I mean, one of the most important weapons nowadays is using, you know, basically starving people of money and resources and also, of course, seizing assets. I mean, this is one of the reasons why I think Libya was seen as a pariah by the West, is because they weren't in debt. You know, this is and one of the things you can do with a country like that is you can take loads of their wealth and you can actually just grab it and steal it and seize it and maybe give a little bit back to the government later. But this whole idea of economic warfare, I mean, we don't do this colonial thing by actually marching around the world so much anymore. Obviously, that is happening. But one of the main reasons that many of the countries in the world are now enthralled to the financial criminals is because they've used the IMF and the World Bank and the Bank for International Settlements to get these countries massively into debt and to basically rape them financially. So this is a really, you know, a replacement in a way for sending armies around the world, is you just have a sort of financial warfare unit.
Well, Jefferson said that the banks were more dangerous than standing armies, and I guess they're proving to be. That's the fact, isn't it?
It is. And, I mean, the other thing is, of course, atomic weapons, still very important. One thing I will say, George, about the whole situation with Iran and Israel, and, I mean, some people criticize me for this, but back in the 1990s, we had a guy called Roger Cook, who's written various books, if people want to check it out. He was a TV reporter here in Britain. He was pulling 10 million viewers every week with his program called The Cook Report. He would stick his camera in the faces of people that didn't really want that camera in their face, crooks of various types. One of the programs he did on arms dealers, and in that program he was actually offered weapons grade plutonium, This is about 1996-97, the show. And some scientists, he said, well, look, how do I know it is? And they gave him a little sample of it. He took it back to Cambridge University, and they had a look at it, and they said, yes, that is weapons-grade plutonium. Now, if a TV reporter can get hold of real weapons-grade plutonium on the black market, ex-Soviet stuff apparently it was, then don't tell me that the poor old Iranians have to go to a centrifuge, blah, 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 to get hold of this stuff. I think we're being
Thank you, Tony. Okay, good night.